Roger LeMaitre, Homeland Uranium, how are you?
Doing great. How about yourself?
Doing really well. Thanks for joining me. We are at the 2025 Rules Symposium. Roger, you've been doing this a long time. Is there a different vibe in 25 and at this symposium that you've seen in the past couple of years even?
Oh, without a doubt. The uranium industry is in a completely different place, or in the nuclear industry for that matter, than it's been probably in my lifetime. And I've been doing this for over 25 years now. There's, when you go back in the uranium industry, I don't think there's ever been a situation or time where it's been globally accepted like it is today, whether you like the clean air energy benefits, whether you're worried about energy security, whether it's AI demand needs for power. There's never been a more exciting time, probably even going back to the 70s, for the uranium and nuclear industries.
Well, let's work that out a little bit too, because this is a cyclical business. You're seeing a lot of interest and even money flow coming into the uranium space. That being said, probably we've had a rough, or I would say pretty significant correction. We got a great bounce here recently in the last 9 months. Do you think that correction is over? And why did we even have that? Did we just get too far out?
The hard part for investors, when you look at the uranium industry, is everyone can only really follow the spot price. And the spot price is only one-fifth, maybe, of the story. And so when you follow the spot price and it comes up and it comes back down, the market follows, you know, things are on the downslope. But meanwhile, all the indicators in the space are actually going in the other direction. And it's not just sentiment. It's when you look at the uranium space and how uranium is procured by the utilities, you look at things like conversion and enrichment, they're at all-time highs and they didn't dip. And we, you know, in the last 12 months, we've seen the uranium market that is, I wouldn't say it's unique, because we've seen it before. A place where we were in backwardation and the spot price was higher than the term price. And unlike other markets, when that happens, buyers step out of the industry, or out of the buying spot. You have utilities that are buying spot, not as much, they buy term. You have your speculators, you have your investors, and you have your producers that actually buy spot and turn it into terms. And they're not going to do that if they're going to get a haircut. Your mid-carry trade contracts disappear too, because you don't loan at $100 uranium and buy it back at $65. So until the term price came up to $80, we saw things go back into a more normal market with a $7 to $12 spread between term and spot. And then we had all the tariff issues that have come into the play. And so utilities are actually not sure what to do. Do we buy now? Do we buy not? Do we buy from Canada? Do we buy from, is the Russians going to be able to come back in? So basically, you're quoting up their demand because they're waiting to see what's going to happen. So I do believe we're going to see another jump in the uranium price, because when you have a 3-year window to take yellow cake and turn it into a fuel pellet, and you start taking 12 months out of that window, and your forward eating indicators are still at all time highs. You're not seeing demand drop off for conversion or enrichment right now. It's poised to move again.
Yeah, and it seems to me that when it moves, it really, really moves. It plays catch up. It'll be dogment. Is that the word? It won't go anywhere, or it'll significantly correct. But then it's like the fundamentals catch up to. People realize the fundamentals, if you would, in the market, then you get this super move all of a sudden.
The fundamentals this cycle are different than last. Last cycle, you had an industry that wasn't really growing. You got Chinese coming in, starting to build reactors, so there was modest growth happening in the space. And meanwhile, you had projects having troubles dropping off. But all of the excess demand was taken up by Kazakhstan, went from 2002, 2003, making 5 million pounds a year to making 55 million pounds. So all of that pent-up demand was satisfied. You go out this time, and you're going, wow, we're going to see there's 31 countries that are going to triple capacity in nuclear generation by 2040. You have China doubling by 2040. You have the U.S. looking to quadruple output. And there's no Kazakhstan in the wings waiting to pick up slack.
Right.
That, to me, that's...
Yeah, it looks like a great bull market coming. One for the ages. Let's talk a little more granular here. First, again, you've had this huge career of the past 25 years where you've done exploration, you've done development, you worked for a major, if you would. And that's given you a lot of experience about how to evaluate a company to invest in. Mm-hmm. What would you tell investors looking to get exposure into the space? How do you evaluate? Yeah, how do you evaluate when you're your uranium company?
I think I break it into three parts, and it's not a surprise. You got your producers and advanced developers, your explorer developers, and you have your pure grassroots explorers. And so it comes down to your risk tolerance, right? If you like the uranium market, you want to get direct exposure, you go with the producer. You go up with a Cameco,
right?
Or Energy Fuels, and you follow what goes on with, you know, they'll leverage nicely to the price with relatively low risk. If you want to see growth opportunities, you go into the developers and explorers. But the big difference between the developers and explorers, you got the upside growth. They got to have a management team that can actually carry it to the finish line. You have to have be in the right jurisdictions. You can actually move in a timely fashion, because if you're not, you can sit forever. And those jurisdictions have changed over the last few years, for sure. And then you go to the explorers, the pure explorers, and that's the part that probably in the current market really hurts, because those groups don't generally have resources. And the investors today are valuing the difference between resource-bearing companies and non-resource-bearing companies. And so, yeah, especially if you're in Athabasca Basin, you can always hit a Grand Slam home run in a grassroots project. We've seen that with NextGen and Fission and Hathor and such over the last 10 years. But it's higher risk, so and much harder to finance. So yeah, and much less liquid. So depending on what your goals are, if you want massive upside potential growth, you leverage a basket of explorers. If you want, you know, lower risk growth, but underpinned by resources, you go with developers. And if you want to be leveraged to the price itself, you do the spot fund, or you do the producers.
Yeah, got it. How important in the uranium market is a jurisdiction?
Critical.
Tell me about that.
Critical. I mean, my time at Cameco and some of the jurisdictions that were out there that we were looking at, you're bringing people to come visit Canadian regulators to show them what they need to do, what are the things they got to look out for. And if you're starting there, it's a long road to the finish line.
Right.
But the strange part in the uranium world, with a couple of exceptions, the good jurisdictions from a jurisdictional operating permitting point of view are also the good mining jurisdictions for uranium, so it does work out pretty well.
Tell me about the permitting process within the jurisdictions. Is it much different than a regular mining, let's say a gold mining or a copper mine, that can be very time sensitive, if you would, meaning, you know, if you go into certain jurisdictions, it's going to take you 5 to 10 years to get a permit. Different ones, if you do on private lands or state lands, it's going to be a year to 2 years. I've seen it happen that quickly. Is that the same time frame for uranium, or is it quicker or longer?
Usually, historically, uranium has been longer.
Okay.
There's a lot more social license needed to make things go, because people don't understand the true risks involved, which aren't really any different than any other mining. I think today you're seeing a lot of turmoil, because traditional districts that take longer seem to be taking shorter.
Mm-hmm.
They're moving faster, and that really has to do with energy security concerns that are out in the world today. And some of the more favorable jurisdictions seem to take a long time. And so it's shifting.
Yeah,
you're seeing things in Canada become more difficult over time and take longer. We're seeing things in the United States seemingly on the process taking a shorter period of time. Most jurisdictions takes a lot, you know, you're in that 7 to 10 year window for the most part, if not longer.
Got it. Let's go even more granular now. Let's talk about Homeland here. Tell us about Homeland Uranium, and the questions that I like to ask is, first, tell me about the projects, where they're at, where are you at in the Lassonde curve, if you would. Typically, to all my viewers and listeners, I try to get really early, or I try to get late, or see deep value that I see in the middle. Where are you in that? And then tell me about your projects.
If you want to be technical, we're an explorer, but we're an inch away from being a developer. And what I mean by that is our projects are in northern Colorado. Our flagship is the Coyote Basin project. We have a project about 10 kilometers to the west that's called Red Wash. It covers very favorable stratigraphy that's known to contain uranium. The Coyote Basin project was found as an actual historical resource at 35 million pounds, which we have the data for, but we can't necessarily convert that particular data to a current resource. You have to do a little bit more work for sure. But what it does, it was found by Western Mining back in 1979, right around the time that Three Mile Island happened, and the entire uranium industry, particularly in the United States, went dead.
Right.
So Western Mining was probably one of the world's best explorers back in the day. They found Olympic Dam. They're now part of the BHP group. They defined this resource. The industry collapsed. They let property lapse. And it was picked up into the last cycle by Energy Fuels. And when they rolled into Uranium One, into the Russians, it was allowed to drop. And the vendor of the project we talked to last summer was doing some research, did some LSEC funding, said, oh, there's a very large resource that's never been, it's open for staking, so let's stake it. And so we did. And when I first got the property shown to me, I said, oh, there's no way. I would have heard of this. Like, I've been around long enough that if there's a 35 million pound resource in the United States, I know about it. I may not know enough about it, but I know about it, that it exists. And so I was pretty skeptical. And then we did the research. I was like, oh, wow, actually, this is here. And then we were able to acquire the data set and go, wow, we're onto something. But what we need to do is convert that resource. So we know where to drill these holes because we have the old data. We know where they've interpreted things to be. We just have to go and do actually the drilling to convert it from a historic resource to an inferred resource. Our plan is to do that by the middle of next year at the latest, probably sooner, and then decide whether or not this warrants infill drilling and advanced engineering studies. But while we're doing that, we're going to do the first step of 4 or 5 metallurgical things to convert this, to see if we can bring more modern technology to conventional resources here in the United States. The thing heap leach with an ion exchange recovery, which others have talked about, but there's been so many advances since 1979 when heap leaching was last done in the uranium space in the United States. And things like alkaline leach that Paladin does in Namibia, etc. We can apply that, maybe it becomes, we help change the cost curve for some of these projects. We're shallow, the resources within 250 feet of surface, it's very shallow dipping, there's 4 horizons, they're all mineralized. And we think there's mineralization. We know we have a strike extension potential. We have on both north and south, but also potential between the horizon, which is very, very technical, but wasn't sampled extremely well back in the day.
Got it. So really then, what is the plan for that you have and the vision that you have for Homeland? Are you really have every intentions or comment about what you can of taking this all the way through, or what is the plan?
I think if you're in the uranium space and your plan is to turn around and sell this project in a year, you're doing your shareholders a disservice, because there's not, unlike the gold or the copper space, there's not as many players, there's not as many buyers, and those that are out there are extremely conservative. Mm-hmm. Your Cameco's, your Rano's, that, they need to take it really far before someone makes you an offer. So you have to be poised. I'll say, do what NextGen's been doing, and it's follow it to the end. And if someone makes you an offer that you can't refuse, then you throw your arrows and you do it. But you have to be prepared to take it to the finish line.
Excellent. Okay, so let's talk about the company structure, and really specifically the stock structure and the share structure. What I like to ask companies is typically, and this is how I evaluate a junior, is how much cash do they have in the bank? So Roger, how much cash do you have in the bank?
We have just a little over $12 million in the bank.
$12 million
Canadian.
In Canadian. So $10 million in the US or $9 million in the US.
Yeah, so that will carry us through this first program, our G&A for the first year, and probably our second program as well.
Yeah.
You know, we're also sit on, with the financing that we did in March, we did a half warrant as well at 50 cents for 2 years. So if things go well, we should be relatively well financed.
Okay. So that will take you through then, and then what, I guess, drilling more holes,
I'm not a miner of mining drill holes for the sake of getting data into the
market.
That
is music to my ears, because most geologists are going to put as many drill holes as they can.
And I know that's not necessarily the best approach, but it's the best way to save capital.
Right.
And to be fair to your shareholders. So first milestone is this first drill program to get to an inferred resource.
Yeah.
And if we do the inferred resource and we do the first steps of the heap leach testing program, we can decide whether or not infill drilling is warranted. And if we do, so that's somewhere around about this time next year, we should have that done. And then we'll be in a position to go, is this a viable, start those engineering studies, decide if this is a viable project. That'll take another 6 months to do. And then if so, we start doing the permitting and engineering process work that done, and that's a 5 to 7 year process thereafter.
Sure.
But yes, it's a relatively, from what we know right now, not having seen the rocks other than on surface, because we're right now doing a field exploration program to prove up what Western Mining had. Not just what did they have, but where exactly it's located, because stuff in the 1970s has a little bit of ability to migrate on today's GPS type maps. It could be a little bit this way, a little bit that way. We're finding that what we saw there, or so in the data, is actually what we're seeing on the ground. So it gives us a lot of confidence that what we're going to drill is going to be what we reported. But the drilling is not detailed enough to make today's resource standards.
So. Excellent. So, okay, let's go back to share structure. How many shares fully diluted do you have out there?
We're about 135 million shares fully diluted.
So relatively tight.
So relatively tight. Insiders and management and directors own 18%. The vendor that bought into the project is a consortium of a group of people. They own collectively 15%. Their shares are on a three-year escrow, and about one-third of the management and director shares are on a three-year escrow. So that three-year escrow would have started in March. So our first, it's every 6 months, here's 15% removal, that's right, release of those shares.
Okay, where are the options and warrants written? What strike?
The strike price for options and warrants will vary. I was in before everything happened, minor and in the 15 cent range, but all of those warrants and options are at 30 cents.
Okay.
For all shares and directors, because they weren't granted until the deal closed.
So right now you're deep in the money or you're right at the money?
Correct.
Got it. Okay. What's a catalyst that's really going to move the stock, come take me from now until the end of the year?
Yeah. When I look at our company and I compare it to our peer companies, there's two things that really are the catalyst. One is converting that resource. We're a new company, people don't know our story, so they haven't put us up against our peers and say, how do we rate? So getting the news out and doing the drilling should be enough to re-rate the company on its own. But I'm going to argue with our shareholders that the advantage we have is all of our resources are in one project, one deposit. And so less jurisdictional issues, less jurisdictional risk, less capital cost issues. And yes, you could argue that one jurisdiction means you're subject to one jurisdiction's subject rules. But
right. Well, I'm not going to argue that. I'm going to say that's a different way of looking at things, because typically you want three or four projects in different jurisdictions. But I can see how that can get things convoluted and even be expensive too.
I look in the uranium space and go, okay, well, would I rather have 35 million pounds in three deposits in three states? Because there's CapEx. The CapEx is going to be more combined to get those things together. Your permitting risk is higher, for sure. But one of the things you can do in the uranium space, when you have enough of a pound that you can get a 10-year window on any particular operation, which is, I think we could look at this if we can convert it over to be that, is you can enter different parts of the contracting market that you can't when you're running a 5 million pound mine.
Right.
So I think it creates some advantages that way.
Got it. Well, Roger, if people want to know more about you, how do they find you? What exchanges are you traded on? What are your ticker symbols?
So we're trading on our primary exchange is the Venture Exchange in Toronto under the symbol HLU. We just started about 2 weeks ago trading on the OTCQB under HLUC or HLUCF. We trade on Frankfurt as well under D3U.
Excellent. What's your website?
homeland-uranium.com.
Excellent. I will put all of this in the show notes below on the YouTube channel as well as the Apple and Spotify channels. Roger, I want to thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. I'm looking forward to potentially investing in you and your company and learning more about the story and following you along.
Well, thank you very much, and we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you so much.